Who sold Joseph in Egypt? Source Criticism in Genesis 37 by Robert E. Longacre and Robert C. Newman. Brief abstract of the talk. Critical scholars have regularly divided up Genesis 37 narrative of Joseph being sold as a slave into Egypt. They claim that variations, tensions, and contradictions in the story point to an account which has been assembled from at least two divergent sources, J and E. They see here a Reuben story and a Judah story, disagreement on whether the slave traders were Ishmaelites or Midianites, and the use of the variant names Israel and Jacob for the father of Joseph and his brothers. Here we suggest, using discourse analysis, that these features can be demonstrated to fall within the range of effective narrative style by a single author. The author used sources. These are completely irrecoverable and probably bore no resemblance to the traditional JEDP of source criticism. The JEDP theory, or the documentary hypothesis, or the Wellhausen theory, claims that the Torah is made up of typically four sources, which they label J, E, D, and P. These sources are said to be identifiable in a particular passage by differing styles, differing names, presence of repetition, and the presence of tensions or contradictions. The narrative of Joseph being sold into Egypt in Genesis 37 is alleged to be a classic example of a passage which can be so analyzed. This passage is claimed to be an editorial combination of two of those sources, J and E. Though these sources have similar narrative styles, flowing narrative, etc., we have these name differences here, Israel or Jacob for Joseph's father, Ishmaelites or Midianites for the slave traders. In addition, we also have two stories, they claim, a Reuben story in which Reuben acts as Joseph's protector, plans to rescue Joseph at the crucial time, and a Judah story in which Judah is the protector. He convinces the brothers to sell Joseph as a slave rather than put him to death. Ephraim Spicer, in his Anchor Bible Commentary in Genesis, claims that the J document uses the name Israel, features Judah as Joseph's protector, and identifies the Ishmaelites as those who bought Joseph from his brothers. The E document, he says, uses the name Jacob, has Reuben as Joseph's protector, and says the slave traders were Midianites, and they found Joseph in the pit and sold him rather than buying Joseph from his brothers. So, this is the problem. Is the account unified or composite? Is Genesis 37 a unified passage by single author, which has Joseph's brothers sell him into slavery, or is Genesis 37 a deceptively smooth combination of two sources, one of which has Joseph sold by his brothers to the Ishmaelites, and the other has Midianites take Joseph from the pit and sell him as a slave in Egypt? A proposed solution. We're going to suggest that discourse analysis points to unity. What is discourse analysis? Well, this little target diagram over in the left upper corner shows you something of what's going on here. In linguistics, the most basic units of text are the morphemes, the features that indicate differences in grammatical function, and the phonemes, the minimal differences in sound of the words. And then above that, you put these together into words, and so you get vocabulary and different meanings for different vocabulary words, or even several meanings for particular vocabulary words. Then you've got the grammar, which organizes these words into meaningful sentences, and that's the syntax, if you like. And then you've got the overall structuring, and this is the discourse. What is the person saying? How has he organized the paragraphs and such? Well, suggestion here made by Longacre, is that the smoothness is not deceptive, as Spicer claims, but is evidence of the narrative's discourse unity. He says that contemporary discourse analysis, when applied to this text, as we do to present-day texts, can explain the text as it stands. Longacre has had considerable experience. He's a linguist, professor of linguistics at University of Arlington in Texas, and worked for many years with the Wycliffe Bible Translators or the Summer Institute of Linguistics, and so working with many different language groups, and not only doing linguistic work himself, but advising people who are for the first time putting down various languages into writing and trying to help them understand what's going on and how things are done in that particular language group. He says that the text features can be shown to fall within the range of effective narrative style by a single author. Longacre's procedure is to examine Genesis 37 in the context of the Joseph story as a whole, and then to examine in order the macro structures of the Joseph story, large-scale structures, the typically recursive nature of the text, how the text actually consists of a series of narratives, its conventions for participant identification, and the ways in which narrator indicates the high point of a story by special stylistic devices. So we start with macro structures, the picture here in the upper right. To understand the Bible text, you need to study the big picture. And that's not only true of understanding Bible texts, that's really true of understanding virtually any text, whether it be spoken or written in whatever language. You need to look at the bigger picture. Huh? What are macro structures? A macro structure is the overall plan by which we can see a discourse or a narrative in terms of the parts in relation to the whole. So the first question we ask ourselves is, what is the Joseph story all about? That's its macro structure, main theme, if you like. And then how does this overall plan indicate the various features seen in the parts of the story? So whether certain things will be included or excluded in the whole story or in certain places in the story, how various features will be balanced against one another, the amount and type of elaboration that the narrator will make. So let's think first about macro structure in Joseph's story. In some stories and discourses, you have to kind of guess or infer what the macro structure is, but it appears in the Joseph story that the macro structure is explicitly given here in two passages where Joseph is interacting with his brothers, one when he is first identified and then one at the end of the story. In Genesis 45, 4 through 7, so Joseph said to his brothers, "Come near to me, please." And they came near. And he said, "I am your brother Joseph, whom you sold into Egypt." So he here identifies himself. And of course, that's a huge sudden revelation to them. "And now do not be distressed or angry with yourselves because you sold me here, for God sent me before you to preserve life. For the famine has been in the land these 2 years, and there are yet 5 years in which there will be neither plowing nor harvest. And God sent me before you to preserve for you a remnant on earth and to keep alive for you many survivors." And then at the very end, in chapter 50, in 50:20, Joseph says, "As for you, you brothers, you meant evil against me, but God meant it for good, to bring about that many people should be kept alive as they are today." So if we try to summarize these verses, the brothers intended to harm Joseph by selling him as a slave in Egypt, but God made this part of his plan to save Jacob's clan and others from death by famine. We can reduce this macro structure to its component parts. And so, one, the brothers' intent to harm Joseph. Two, their perpetrating of this crime. Three, God's plan to make Joseph a savior. Four, the actual deliverance and how it happened. And five, the severity of the famine. Now, the Joseph story is part of the section called Toledot Yaakov. Genesis divide up into a number of parts that start out with Toledot, which have been translated traditionally as "these are the generations of," and the first one is heaven and earth, and this is the last one in chapter 37, the generations of Yaakov, Jacob. And that could be translated, "these are the generations of Jacob," Or here, Longacre suggests the life and times of Jacob. While most of Genesis 37 through 50, as the remainder of the book of Genesis, is a Joseph story, other parts of Jacob's family receive attention here. For instance, Genesis 38 is about Judah and Tamar and not Joseph at all. The blessing on Ephraim and Manasseh in Genesis 48 is the end of the Joseph story proper. His two sons receive the double portion, then, if you like, that means that Joseph is treated as firstborn in the inheritance of Jacob. And then Genesis 49 and 50 deal with larger concerns, though they still involve Joseph. So we can perhaps suggest a broader macro structure. If we take Genesis 49, the place where Jacob on his deathbed gives blessing and testament to the various of the sons, as if we take that as crucial and climatic, we have some material for deducing this broader structure. For instance, the pronouncements regarding the futures of the 12 sons, or the 12 clans that come from them, are given in 49:3-27, 25 verses. Five verses each refer to Judah and Joseph, so making up 10 verses, or 40% of this whole narrative. Two verses refer to Reuben, and three to Simeon and Levi together. Then one each to Zebulun, Gad, Asher, Naphtali, and Benjamin. And two to Issachar, three to Dan. So nobody receives anything close to what Judah and Joseph receive. And five of them receive one verse. Simeon and Levi, if you split this stuff out, although they're mixed together all through it, receive, say, 1.5 verses apiece. Reuben and Issachar, 2, and Dan, 3. That suggests some focus on Joseph and Judah. When we look at the details of these predictions, Judah and Joseph are to be the especially favored ones. Doesn't this shed light on the whole Toledot section, even the story of Joseph within it? We suggest that it does. The Joseph story is really one of three J's. Joseph, his father Jacob, who is really broken up when he hears of Joseph's death, though in fact Joseph hasn't died, and is very fearful that the same thing might happen to Benjamin. And then Judah, who turns out in some sense to be the hero among the other brothers, as we'll see in a bit. But there's also the matter of Reuben and Judah. Reuben, the firstborn, would normally have received the double portion of the inheritance, but doesn't. He's characterized in this narrative by giving inconclusive leadership in times of crisis. He plans to rescue Joseph, but never carries it out, and is given to ineffectual emotional outbursts, one of them right in that chapter, where he is very unhappy about what has happened to Joseph, but then joins in the cover-up with the brothers, and then twice in chapter 42, where he feels, rightly, I suppose, that the disasters that are coming on the brothers are a result of their having mistreated Joseph years earlier. Judah, by contrast, emerges as the hero in Genesis 44, where he volunteers to remain behind as a slave in place of Benjamin, which apparently finally convinces Joseph that his brothers have changed, and leads Joseph then to reveal himself to his brothers. Seen in this light, the Reuben and Judah passages are required by the macro structure of the story, which would not be complete in light of Genesis 49, the blessing and curse passage, if they were not both there. So, by the normal devices of storytelling, a subplot, Reuben versus Judah, is worked into our story in a way to explain one of the major emphases of the story. And if that's so, what is the need for dividing the story into incompatible sources? Yet, we still have to deal with the question of the name Jacob versus Israel, and the question of the Midianites versus the Ishmaelites. That brings us to the matter of recursion and narrative. This picture is perhaps not ideal, the Matryoshka dolls that fit one inside another, but it does remind us that discourses are not simple linear sequences of sentences. Sentences clump into paragraphs, and paragraphs cluster into more complex units, and these units may form embedded discourses which combine to form the main discourse, or in our particular case, we're looking at narrative, a another category of discourse, a narrative sells a story, the structure of a story within a story, or subplot within a plot, is in fact quite common in narratives. In a story of any great complexity, the main episodes are themselves stories with their own narrative structure. So, we see embedded narratives in the Joseph story. I list them here for you. Joseph sold into Egypt in chapter 37. Then 38, you remember, is about Judah and Tamar, so it's not part of the Joseph story. And then Joseph's rise in Potiphar's house, the first six verses of chapter 39. And then the rest of 39, Joseph's ruin through sexual harassment by Potiphar's wife. Then Joseph interprets the courtier's dreams while he's in prison, chapter 40. And follow up a couple of years later, Pharaoh has dreams, and as a result, Joseph is able to interpret them, and he rises to become the second most powerful man in Egypt, chapter 41. In chapter 42, we have the brothers' first trip to Egypt by grain. And then in 43 through 45, their second trip, Judah's speech, and Joseph reveals himself. Chapter 46, Jacob and his clan come to Egypt, and Jacob in 48 gives his blessing on Ephraim and Manasseh, and that's how it goes with the Joseph part of the story. If we seek to evaluate the episodes, the longest episodes here are Pharaoh's dream and Joseph's rise, chapter 41, long chapter, and the second trip, chapters 43 through 45, with Judah's speech and Joseph revealing himself. Both of these are what are called in discourse analysis, narrative analysis, high points or peaks. Chapter 41 is the climax of Joseph's story. Joseph has been degraded several times here, and now he rises because of God's faithfulness to him. And then chapter 43 through 45 resolve the problems between Joseph and his family. But what is the meaning of our episode of Joseph being sold in Egypt, chapter 37? Well, if we evaluate chapter 37, a recognized universal of narrative structure is that a story needs to have an inciting incident. If there's to be a story, something out of the ordinary and unpredictable must happen to lead us into the story. Here in Genesis 37, we meet a dark and vicious happening in Jacob's family. The older brothers sell the younger brother into slavery, and then they cover it up. This is the inciting incident in the whole Joseph story. Like a peak or a high point, an inciting incident is not routine narration, but is narration marked by special features that underscore its dramatic placement in the story. We can expect that certain features of chapter 37 will reflect a heightened style and mode of narration, which may in themselves aggravate the difficulties of analysis in the chapter. So we turn to conventions for participant identification. In narrative discourse, participants, actors, characters, are introduced, integrated into the story, and identified as either major or minor characters. Major characters continue for most or all of the narrative. Minor characters figure only in particular sections. Participants, once introduced and integrated, must then be tracked, taken on or off stage, and sometimes phased out of the story. Now, we have certain language-specific or culture-specific conventions here. How this is done varies somewhat from language to language or culture to culture. A reader in language B, reading a narrative that was originally in language A and has been translated to B, may understand the conventions in language A and read a narrative as clumsy, incoherent, or disorganized, whereas a reader in the A language group would see it as coherent and even elegant. Differences in conventions, huh? Longacre suggests that certain parts of the Hebrew Bible have suffered from such ethnocentric and biased judgment by scholars who speak modern European languages but are not really familiar with the conventions of the time and place in which various parts of the Hebrew Bible were written. One of these matters is introduction of characters. In the Hebrew Bible, characters are not introduced casually if they're to be at all important. but they come on stage with a certain amount of fanfare. Not true of minor participants referred to by social role, for instance, Joseph Stewart in chapter 43. Joseph is one of the wealthiest men in Egypt at this point, certainly second most powerful, and so it's to be expected that he will have various servants and a top servant in his household, the steward, and so no further reference needs to be made. He's just referred to casually as he comes up and functions in the narrative. But the regular practice in Hebrew is to have multiple initial presentations for a participant who is to be important for an episode or more. For example, take Joseph. In chapter 37, verses 2 and 3, Joseph is introduced. He's named three times. His age is given, his occupation, his circumstances, his relation to his father. Then chapter 38 is about Judah and Tamar. Chapter 39, 1 through 4, Joseph is reintroduced, multiply reintroduced, after the Judah-Tamar material. There's the unidentified man in the mid-chapters of chapter 37, and he's not an important character, but he is important in directing Joseph to the town of Dothan, where his brothers have gone, and which Joseph would otherwise not have found out about, and so important in bringing all this stuff to happen, in some sense. He's referred to three times. He's called a certain man, and then the man, twice. Potiphar, important character in chapter 37, 39. 37, 36, where he first shows up, he's named. He's described as an official, and a captain of the guard. And then after the Judah-Tamar break in 38, in 39, 1 through 6, he's renamed. He's re-described as official, captain of the guard. He's also described as an Egyptian man, and as his master, that is Joseph's master, the Egyptian. Potiphar's wife figures in the latter part of 39, dominates the scene, in fact, and she's called twice his master, that is Joseph's master's wife, for 7 and 8, although the 8 one does not show up in NIV, that's in the Hebrew text, and then his wife in verse 9. After Joseph is imprisoned and interacts with the cupbearer and the cupbearer and the baker show up, and they're introduced in chapter 40, verses 1, 2, and 5, and the references to them seem very repetitious in English. Why do they keep mentioning these things three times, huh? Well, that's a good example of the difference in Hebrew technique from European languages. And it's these sort of things that have led the documentary theory guys to hypothesize different documents when, in fact, we're looking at a Hebrew technique of multiple repetition. Differing names. Narrator will often vary references to a person, and this is done in English some. So Joseph's brothers, for instance, are typically referred to as Joseph's brothers. Okay? Joseph is, after all, the main character in this whole section, and these are his brothers. But when the thematic spotlight is on Israel, that is their father, they're called the sons of Israel. And when the spotlight is on Reuben or on Judah, they're referred to as his brothers, Reuben's brothers, or Judah's brothers. In the Peak passage, chapters 43 to 45, the brothers are, first of all, not referred to at all. Then they're called the men until Joseph reveals himself in chapter 45. This may well be seen from the perspective of the steward, who doesn't know who these guys are and wonder why Joseph's interested in them or something of that sort. But still, we get this difference in ways of referring to what is in fact one group. Divine names. Of course, the divine names Yahweh and Elohim have been a big theme in the documentary hypothesis that they allegedly indicated the Yahweh indicated the J document and Elohim indicated the E document. But here, Yahweh is used only in the two low points of the story, right after Joseph is sold as a slave, and when he has been imprisoned after the false accusation by Potiphar's wife. And the writer is perhaps indicating that the promise-keeping personal God, Yahweh, is intervening to encourage Joseph in these two disastrous things that he has not ceased to operate. Elsewhere, the more generic name Elohim, God, is used to refer to God. How about the Israel-Jacob name variation? It's a little bit different than Abraham. You remember Abram was Abraham's original name, and that was upscaled, we might say, to Abraham when God makes special promises to him, so he's no longer exalted father of Ram, but he is now father of a multitude. But once Abraham has been renamed, he's not referred to as Abraham anymore. Not the case with Israel Jacob, Jacob's name, the one who tries to supplant his brother, is now replaced by Israel, the one who is a prince with God, if you like. But both names continue to be used. And Longacre suggests here that Jacob is used to emphasize him as a suffering, feeling human, perhaps a fallible human, etc. And Israel is used to represent his dignity and particularly his office as the head of the clan, if you like. Well then, what about the Ishmaelites versus the Midianites? We have reference to Ishmaelite in three places, 37:25, 37:28b, and 39:1, and reference to Midianite in two places, 37:28a, and 37:36. So, well, what's going on here? If the two terms refer to the same group, just like Joseph's brothers and the sons of Israel or something like that, if they refer to the same group, there's no problem here. The point of the JE analysis is they don't refer to the same group, and therefore they are contradictory. Is there any evidence the two names overlap? And the answer is yes. In Judges chapter 6 through 8, Gideon fights the Midianites. You remember, his army is reduced to 300 men, and they sneak up at night, surround the camp, and they break their pottery, and now the torch inside of each pot can be seen, and they shout out a sword for the Lord and Gideon and blow trumpets, and the Midianites get all confused and start killing each other in the dark and they're running around, etc. Well, they finally defeat the Midianites, Gideon and his men do, and in discussion of the spoil afterwards, Judges 8:24b calls them Ishmaelites. Longacre suggests here, then, that the two names overlap, and that perhaps Ishmaelite was used somewhat like we use the term Bedouin today, as a broader term rather than a specific tribal term. Here's the passage. We go back to Judges 8:22, but Midian has been referred to lots of times before this. The Israelites said to Gideon, "Rule over us, you, your son, your grandson, because you have saved us from the hand of Midian." But Gideon said, "I will not rule over you, nor will my son rule over you. The Lord will rule over you." And he said, "I do have one request, that each of you give me an earring from your share of the plunder." It was the custom of the Ishmaelites to wear gold earrings. Where do the Ishmaelites come from in here? Well, the suggestion is that Ishmaelites is presumably a broader category of which Midian is a subcategory, and that they wear gold earrings, and so there's a bunch of these in the plunder, and they will be given over to Gideon then. Multiple initial presentation then regarding Ishmaelites and Midianites. If they don't refer to the same group here, then the writer does not give proper introduction to the Midianites. But if they do refer to the same group, then the author follows his usual method. But why does the author mention Midianites, 37:28, in an almost misleading way? Certain Midianite merchants. This leads us to another point of discourse theory, the unusual feature of peaks or high points. Peaks as zones of turbulence, taking an analogy from air flight, where turbulence causes a smooth air flight to suddenly become a very bumpy one. The air is not flowing as straight as it is, but it's up and down and in little whirls and things of that sort. Longacre says that the structure at a peak is not the same as the structure in routine narration. And he's had many examples of this in working with advising various language translators in different groups, where they're often reducing a language to a written form for the first time, and they've been doing very well trying to figure out how to translate something, and suddenly they hit a very bumpy section, and it often turns out it's the peak in the narration that is going on. The point is here that the narrator makes an effort to be sure that the peak does not go by too fast. He wants his listeners, his readers, to savor the events at the peak point of the narrative. And he does this by some form of rhetorical underlining. For instance, the event line may be packed, lots of stuff happening close together, or it may be extended. The narrator may spread out the event line. The stage may be crowded with participants. There may be shifts in tense, in sentence length, or more dialogue, or less dialogue. You can't tell for sure because underlining is done different ways in different cultures. Applied to Genesis 37, this chapter, as we said, is the inciting incident of the Joseph story, and inciting incidents have some peak-like characteristics. The narrator feels it's important for the listener, the reader, to understand what set all this story going. Besides this, Genesis 37 is itself an embedded narrative, of which verses 5 through 11 is the inciting narrative of this whole big inciting narrative, and that's Joseph's dreams. It's Joseph's dreams, plus the coat of many colors, that set off the brothers' jealousy and anger, and particularly it seems like the dreams are the straw that breaks the camel's back, so to speak. In verses 12 through 17, Jacob has sent his son Joseph to seek his brothers. And then in 18 through 22, the brothers see Joseph coming at a distance. They conspire to get rid of him, and the tension increases. Then verses 23 to 28 is the peak, where they take Joseph and strip him of his coat and throw him in the pit, etc., and eventually sell him. And 29 through 35 is post-peak, the cover-up. So, Genesis 37, 23 to 28 is the peak of this chapter 37 narrative. We see several features there. The opening verbs anticipate a crescendo of activity. Certain details are added, a reference to Joseph's hated cloak, the pit they're going to throw him in, that it's an empty pit, and that a caravan is coming. Then in 28, we have the repetition three times of Joseph's name, and Longacre suggests it's almost like a bell tolling for Joseph. Joseph, Joseph, Joseph. Longacre suggests that delayed identification of the Ishmaelite caravan, mentioned in verse 25, but not identified as Midianite until 28, is an example of suspense at peak, and also maybe necessary that the caravan come close enough that you can tell it's not just a camel caravan, but it's a caravan of specifically Midianites. In Genesis 37, 23 to 28, the peak passage here, we see parallelism between the peak and the previous episode. The conspiracy looks like this. In verse 18, the brothers see Joseph from afar. In 19 through 22, they consider how to dispose of him, and then explode into activity on his arrival in 23-24, and that's parallel to the peak. The brothers see the caravan far off, 25. They consider how to use the caravan, 26 and 27, and there's a spate of activity on the caravan's arrival, verse 28. So, Longacre says, the story's an artful construction, just as it stands, that is, without dividing it into sources. The caravan first sighted at a distance as Ishmaelite, Bedouin, proves on closer inspection to be Midianite, and Joseph is sold to them. The suspense is artful and effective. Reuben, away on an errand, misses the sale, is very concerned, but joins in the cover-up. So, some conclusions. Huh? Who sold Joseph? Careful attention to discourse structure of Genesis 37 in the context of the whole Joseph story fits the traditional view. His brother sold him. This fits Joseph's words when he reveals himself in 45, verses 4 and 5, where he twice refers to their having sold him. It also fits chapter 50, verses 17 through 20, where the brothers are asking forgiveness for treating Joseph so badly, and Joseph agrees, "You intended to harm me." The macro structure indicates that Joseph's story is a story of God's providence, working good for Joseph when his brothers intended evil. It's a subset of the Jacob story, and the blessing on Judah and the curse on Reuben in Genesis 49 is partly explained by a subplot in the Joseph story. There's no need to invoke discrepant sources, J and E. Regarding embedded narratives, the Joseph story is made up of a number of embedded substories. Genesis 37 functions as the inciting incident for the whole Joseph story, but also contains narrative sub-elements within, of which the crucial verses, 23 to 28, are the local peak, with typical peak characteristics. Conventions of participant identification. Hebrew narrative regularly introduces important characters by multiple references to them, which often seems repetitious and redundant to speakers of European languages. If Ishmael and the Midianites refer to the same group, then the Midianites are properly introduced. If not, they're not properly introduced. The use of multiple names for characters seems to be common in Hebrew usage, as, say, in Russian novels, and need not point to diverse sources. Devices and high points. A peak is typically a zone of turbulence and analytical difficulty. The peak in Genesis 37, 23 to 28 features slowing down to build tension, the death toll-like repetition of Joseph, parallelism between verses 16 through 24 and 25 through 28, the delayed identification of the traitors. Thus, there's no need to see contradiction in the naming of the traitors. Conclusion, the smoothness is not deceptive, but is evidence of the narrative's discourse unity. Contemporary discourse analysis, when applied to this ancient text, as we do to present-day texts, can explain the text as it stands. The text features can be shown to fall within the range of effective narrative style by a single author. So, we've reached the end of our discussion. I hope it'll help you to see that this Joseph story is not a clever but clumsy working together of two separate documents, but in fact is a careful narration by one author, but using the narrative techniques of his time and place. Thank you very much for your attention, and we trust the Lord will encourage you in this.